This is Audible.
Become What You Are. Written by Alan Watts. Narrated by Jeremy Stockwell. Copyrighted by Mark Watts. This audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Mark Watts and was produced in the year 2024 by Echo Point Books and Media, LLC, which holds the copyright thereto. Editor's Preface. As the title suggests, Become What You Are is a collection of Alan Watts's writings that touch on the dilemma of the person who seeks his or her true self, a quest so often undertaken at the expense of seeing one's life just as it is. As Alan Watts wrote, "Life exists only at this very moment, and in this moment it is infinite and eternal. For the present moment is infinitely small. Before we can measure it, it has gone, and yet it persists forever. This movement and change has been called Tao by the Chinese. A sage has said that if we try to accord with it, we shall get away from it. But he was not altogether right. For the curious thing is that you cannot get out of accord with it, even if you want to. Though your thoughts may run into the past or the future, they cannot escape the present moment." Understood in this way, to become what you are is at once an impossible directive and an unavoidable fact. This volume is a collection of Alan Watts's articles from the mid-50s, interspersed with short essays from the late 30s, written before he came to America from England. The shorter pieces appeared originally in The Middle Way, a journal published by the Buddhist Lodge of London. The collection begins with The Paradox of Self-Denial. Although the original manuscript is not dated, the typewriter used to write this piece was acquired in 1953, and the content and length are consistent with other articles that were originally read aloud by Watts on KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California, beginning in 1955. These broadcasts were quite popular and continued for over 30 years. The second chapter, and the first of the short essays, is the title piece of this volume and was taken from a scrapbook of Watts's early articles. An examination of the back of the clippings reveals the announcement of meetings of the Buddhist Lodge in March, April, and May 1938. The third chapter, The Finger and the Moon, was retitled thus in Watts's hand, having originally been titled The Realm of the Spirit. It is dated April 17, 1955, and addresses the shortcomings of Western religious practice in the context of Zen and Asian thought generally. Then, in Chapter 4, we return to The Middle Way essays with Importance, a beautiful little piece on the perspective of a Buddhist poem. In Tao and Wu Wei, the fifth chapter, Watts writes about the significance of not doing and not forcing, ideas central to Chinese Taoism. Midway through the original text, he mentions these 2 years of talks, referring to the initial public radio series. This probably was one of the latter talks in that series, and his handwritten revisions in the last 4 pages of the original suggest that this article may have been transcribed from a recording, making it perhaps one of his first broadcasts not read from a script, but originally performed before a live radio audience. Walking on the Wheel, the sixth chapter, is again a short essay from The Middle Way. Here we find Chuang Tzu's perfect man as he walks the wheel, undisturbed by desire, attachment, fear, or regret. On the back side of this clipping, we find an interesting quote attributed to Tan Ching, which reads, "If we allow our thoughts, the past, the present, and the future ones, to link up in a series, we put ourselves under restraint. On the other hand, if we let our mind attach to nothing at all times and towards all things, we gain emancipation." Since Watts was then the editor of The Middle Way, he probably selected the quote for publication. A similar theme was developed throughout his later works, and the quote serves as evidence of the philosophical influences shaping his thinking at the time. The seventh chapter marks our departure from the radio articles to an article written for the Journal of Religious Thought, published in 1953 by Howard University in Washington, D.C. "The Language of Metaphysical Experience" is an excellent analysis of the similarities between the knowledge gained by mystical experience and natural science, and the linguistic problems posed by expressing that variety of knowledge in words. The article is in many ways far ahead of its time, blending Eastern thought, physics, and Western philosophy and religion towards an understanding of life rooted in wonder. For, as he quotes Goethe, "The highest to which man can attain is wonder. And if the prime phenomenon makes him wonder, let him be content. Nothing higher can it give him, and nothing further should he seek for behind it. Here is the limit." Following The Language of Metaphysical Experience, we begin a series of articles from The Middle Way, including Good Intentions, Zen, The One, Is There an Unconscious, The Far-Off Divine Event, The Parable of the Cow's Tail, and The Second Immortal. The Zenist perspective of Watts' early contribution to The Middle Way is fairly represented in the group, followed by the much more serious treatment of Buddhism in The Problem of Faith and Works in Buddhism. The Middle Way selections, later collected in The Modern Mystic, conclude with two more short pieces, with Tomorrow Never Comes and What is Reality, and introduce another longer piece from that period. The Birth of the Divine Son, A Study of a Christian Symbol, was originally published in The Sufi in the late 30s. This is an interesting piece in which Watts delves into the mystical basis of the Christian tradition and compares the symbolism of its divinity with those of other religions more often recognized for their mystical nature. As he writes, "To receive the universe into oneself after the manner of some mystics is simply to become inflated with the conceit that one is God, and so set up yet another opposition between the mighty whole and the degraded part. To give oneself utterly and slavishly to the world is to become a spiritual nonentity, a mechanism, a shell, a leaf blown by the winds of circumstance. But if the world is received and the self given at the same time, there prevails that union which brings forth the second birth." This rings with familiarity of the Buddhist idea of the middle way, as of course it should. And Watts continues along this line of thought, concluding, in a somewhat Taoist vein, "Thus, when we say that out of the union between self and life, or the world, there is born the Christ, we mean that man rises to a new center of consciousness which is neither himself alone or the world alone. Indeed, this center already exists, whether he knows it or not, for no two opposites can exist unless there is a relation between them." Mark Watts, San Anselmo, California. The Paradox of Self-Denial. While living, be a dead man, thoroughly dead. Then, whatever you do, just as you will be right. A Buddhist poem written in China several centuries ago tries to find words for an intuition which is common to almost every culture in the world. When translated into the familiar language of the Christian tradition, it is so well known as to be almost a platitude. He that loseth his soul shall find it. But what always preserves this thought from banality, from the mere tiresomeness of those precepts which everyone knows he ought to observe but doesn't, is that this is a saying which no one can observe. For so long as there is something which I can do about it, I am not yet dead. I have not yet completely lost my life. Yet this is not the simple absurdity of a command impossible to obey. It is a real communication, a description of something which happens to people, like the rain or the touch of the wind. It is simply the expression of the universal discovery that a man does not really begin to be alive until he has lost himself, until he has released the anxious grasp which he normally holds upon his life, his property, his reputation, and his position. It is the irreducible truth in the monkish idea of holy poverty, of the way of life to which there are no strings attached, in which, because all is lost, there is nothing to lose, in which there is the exhilaration of a kind of freedom which is poetically likened to the birds and the wind, or to clouds drifting in the boundless sky. It is the life which St. Paul described as poor, but making many rich, as having nothing but possessing all things. What an unrealistic nostalgia we have for it! Marie Antoinette playing shepherdess in the gardens of Versailles, presidents of great corporations retreating to lonely fishing shacks in the High Sierra, the insurance clerk walking alone on the interminable ocean sands, wondering if he would have the courage to be a beachcomber, or the moral idealist reproaching himself because he does not have quite the strength to abandon a comfortable salary and plunge into the slums like Peter Morin and Dorothy Day, or the great exemplars St. Francis and St. Vincent de Paul. But most of us know that we will not and probably cannot do it, that we shall continue to cling to our habitual ways of life with all the helplessness of addicts to a destroying passion. If this begins to sound like a sermon, I do not mean it that way, for I said at the beginning that the words about finding one's life through losing it were not really a precept that could simply be practiced and obeyed. This is what makes all the talk about the necessity of selflessness or the task of transcending the ego so fantastically misunderstood. Treated as a precept, it makes for every kind of moral and spiritual phoniness. Always have a large pinch of salt handy when you meet a fellow who talks about trying to renounce himself, to overcome his ego. I am reminded of the apocryphal conversation between Confucius and Lao Tzu, when the former had been prating of universal love without the element of self. "What stuff!" cried Lao Tzu. "Does not universal love contradict itself? Is not your elimination of self a positive manifestation of self? Sir, if you would cause the world not to lose its source of nourishment, there is the universe. Its regularity is unceasing. There are the sun and moon. Their brightness is unceasing. There are the stars. Their groupings never change. There are the birds and the beasts, they flock together without varying. There are trees and shrubs. They grow upwards without exception. Like these, accord with the Tao, with the way of all things, and be perfect. Why then, these vain struggles after charity and duty to one's neighbour, as though beating a drum in search of a fugitive? Alas, sir, you have brought much confusion into the mind of man. As I said, the truth about finding life through losing it is not a precept, but a report of something which happens, and happens in many different ways. It is not given to everyone to be an obvious moral hero or a notorious saint. It is not everyone's way to be a rolling stone without the responsibilities of wife and children. Nor, I should add, is it everyone's privilege to be a self-sacrificing wife or a model husband. And still more, it is not everyone's gift to be the contented fatalist accepting himself and his limitations just as they are, knowing that he is a weed and not trying to be a rose. Some of us will always be trying, with an exasperating degree of relative success, to improve ourselves in one way or another, and no amount of self-acceptance will stop it. Self-renunciation, self-acceptance, these are all names for the same thing, for the ideal to which there is no road, the art for which there is no technique. Why then does the whole idea so commonly wear the form of a precept, of advice to be followed, of a method to be applied? For obviously, there is a vital contradiction in the very notion of self-renunciation, and just as much is self-acceptance. People try to accept themselves in order to be different, and try to surrender themselves in order to have more self-respect in their own eyes, or to attain some spiritual experience, some exaltation of consciousness, the desire for which is the very form of their self-interest. We are really stuck with ourselves, and our attempts to reject or to accept are equally fruitless, for they fail to reach that inaccessible center of our selfhood, which is trying to do the accepting or the rejecting. The part of ourself that wants to change ourself is the very one that needs to be changed. But it is as inaccessible as a needle to the prick of its own point. But the reason why the idea of self-renunciation appears in the impossible form of a precept is that it is a form of what Buddhists would call upaya, a Sanskrit term meaning skillful means, and more particularly the skillful means employed by a teacher to awaken his students to some truth which can only be reached in a roundabout way. For the selfishness of the self thrives on the notion that it can command itself, that it is the lord and master of its own processes, of its own motives and desires. Thus, the one important result of any really serious attempt at self-renunciation or self-acceptance is the humiliating discovery that it is impossible. And this precisely is the death to oneself, which is the improbable source of a way of life so new and so alive that it feels like having been born again. In this metaphorical sense, the ego dies on finding out its own incapacity, its inability to make any difference to itself that is really important. That is why, in Zen Buddhism, the task of self-transcendence is likened to a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull. And, in the words of one of the old masters, the transforming death comes about at the very moment when the iron hide of the bull finally and absolutely rejects the mosquito's frail proboscis.